It's Philosophy Talk.
Wisdom is holding two contradictory truths in our mind simultaneously.
If you believe contradictions, what's to stop you from believing anything?
If I'm not happy, and I'm not not happy, isn't that a true contradiction?
If I'm standing in the doorway, can I be indoors and outdoors at the same time?
Can God make a rock so big that he can't move it?
His heart will stop at the very sight of you, where he doesn't deserve to live. And yes, I am aware of the contradiction embodied in that sentence.
This sentence is false. Does that mean it's also true?
Logicians have been struggling with this since it was put on the table by Euvulides 2,500 years ago.
Our guest is Graham Priest from the City University of New York.
No one has succeeded yet in explaining what's wrong with it.
True contradictions.
That's a contradiction in terms if I ever heard one.
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
How could something be both true and false at the same time?
If we accepted contradictions, would we end up believing just anything?
Or would we simply be more open to the mystery of the world?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today, we're thinking about true contradictions.
The world is full of contradictions, Ray, like parting is such sweet sorrow. Parting is sweet, but parting is also sad. And sweetness and sadness are opposite, so contradiction.
That's not a contradiction, Josh. It's just mixed emotions. A real contradiction would be like if Romeo was both sad and not sad. Something would have to be true and not true at the same time.
You mean, okay, like this. I'm lying right now.
Oh, it's the famous liar paradox. So you tell me you're lying, and so if you're actually lying, then the sentence you said is true, in which case you're not lying. But if you're telling the truth, that means you're lying. So either way, you're both lying and telling the truth.
Exactly. So that right there is a true contradiction.
Yeah, nice try. But actually, your sentence wasn't both true and false. It was neither.
Okay, let me rephrase myself, Ray. I'm not telling the truth right now. Okay, get out of that one.
Well, that one is also neither true nor false.
Okay, so that means I wasn't telling the truth, which is exactly what I said, which means I was telling the truth.
That's a lot of logic before I've had my coffee.
I see what you're doing, Ray, trying to use comedy to get out of a tight spot. It's not going to work.
Okay, fair enough, you got me. Maybe I need more coffee so that I can come up with a better answer. But I do know that whatever the story is about these liar paradoxes, true contradictions just cannot exist. Nothing can be both true and false at the same time.
Why not?
Well, think about what would happen. You'd be able to prove just anything. That Santa Claus exists, that birds aren't real, that the moon landing was faked, that pineapple belongs on pizza, like you name it.
I like the pineapple on pizza example, but I don't understand the logic, Ray. How do you get from the liar paradox to the moon landing?
Well, just think about proving things by process of elimination.
Like Sherlock Holmes?
Exactly. So Holmes says, when you have eliminated the impossible, whatever remains, however improbable, must be the truth.
So you're telling me Holmes, the arch-rationalist, is going to help us support conspiracy theories?
Well, if you add true contradictions to the mix, then yeah. Here's how it works. So I want to use the process of elimination to prove something, like say that my enemy committed a murder. So I make a list of hypotheses. One of them is that my enemy committed the murder, and the other is the liar paradox.
That's a weird list, Ray.
Yeah, but we know that one of the hypotheses on the list is true because you said it yourself. The liar paradox, both true and false.
You're going to make a great detective.
Yeah, but you see where I'm going, right? By process of elimination, I can get rid of all the false hypotheses on my list. And guess which one we know is false?
Oh no, what have I done?
Yup! Since the liar paradox is false, the only remaining possibility is that my enemy is the murderer.
Could it be my enemy instead?
I mean, sure, it can be whatever you want.
I admit I'm kind of tempted, Ray, but still, I do think we can embrace the idea of true contradictions without giving up on reason and common sense. and without framing anybody for crimes. I bet our guest will back me up. It's Graham Priest, professor of philosophy at the City University of New York, and author of the book Doubt Truth to Be a Liar.
But first, we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to look for true contradictions in literature, including the Bible. She files this report.
It's perfectly reasonable to want truth and order, but literature is unlikely to help with that. Fiction is filled with paradoxes, plot holes, and unreliable narrators.
It is midnight. The rain is beating on the windows.
That's from Samuel Beckett's novel Molloy. Later, the narrator describes another version of reality.
I do not know. I shall learn. Then I went back into the house and wrote, "It is midnight. The rain is beating on the windows." It was not midnight. It was not raining.
Another example, The Sepulchre Girl Diaries by George Saunders. The narrator, who was keeping a diary, writes,
"Do not really like rich people, as they make us poor people feel dopey and inadequate. Not that we are poor. I would say we are middle. We are very, very lucky. I know that. But still, it is not right that rich people make us middle people feel dopey and inadequate."
Then the next day, he writes a clarification.
"I am not tired of work. It is a privilege to work. I do not hate the rich, I aspire to be rich myself. And when we finally do get our own bridge, trout, treehouse, SGs, etc., at least we will know we really earned them. Unlike, say, the Torinis, who I feel must have family money."
What's true, what's false, everything. As novelist and Vietnam vet Tim O'Brien writes in How to Tell a True War Story,
"Absolute occurrence is irrelevant. A thing may happen and be a total lie. Another thing may not happen and be truer than the truth."
Fiction is important and all, but what about the Bible, the most widely circulated book in history? Biblical texts are filled with contradictions.
I think that there are lots of truths that can be found in biblical books.
Jennifer Knust is a professor of religious studies at Duke University.
I don't think that the truths are going to be consistent, but rather an opportunity to reflect on how messy it is to be alive and to try to figure out how to be human.
In 2011, Knust published Unprotected Text, the Bible's surprising contradictions about sex and desire, at a time when sexuality was also a biblical battleground. In this interview from that period, Piers Morgan talked to American televangelist Joel Osteen.
What's your view now?
You know, Piers, it really never changes because mine's based out of the scripture. That's what I believe, that the scripture says, that homosexuality is a sin. So, I believed it before and I still believe it now.
The Ethics and Religious Library Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention had filed a brief before a district court in favor of Proposition 8, the California ballot initiative that said marriage must be between one man and one woman. The brief argues Southern Baptists have no choice but to oppose same-sex marriage. Knust found that all very frustrating because there is no biblical sexual standard.
I just thought things that were being said around how the Bible is some kind of clear rule book about sexual morals was just so wrong and so bad for the Bible and so bad for us as human beings who are trying to come up with a way to be sexually moral and kind and compassionate beings to one another sexually and in every other way.
In the New Testament, there are letters ascribed to the Apostle Paul, who says he wishes everyone could be celibate like him.
Verse 1, 1 Corinthians 7. "Now concerning the matters about which you wrote, it is good for a man not to have sexual relations with a woman, but because of the temptation..."
He thinks that Jesus is returning soon for the second coming to bring heaven and earth together into a new creation. And why would you waste your time getting married when you could be celibate and concentrate on getting ready for that event?
"But then come together again so that Satan may not tempt you because of your lack of self-control."
Then there's another letter, possibly written by Paul, depending on what you believe, called 1 Timothy, where an opposite argument is made.
In fact, there's a passage in the letters to Timothy where younger widows are specifically told that they should get married again. And also young women are told that they are saved through childbearing, which is a pretty different argument than is in 1 Corinthians.
Knust says contradictions are an invitation to pay attention. Her mom was an amateur Bible scholar. Growing up, they would read a big picture Bible together on a big gold couch, and her mom encouraged her to ask questions. She's still part of Christian communities that are open to multiple interpretations.
And consider love and kindness and generosity and compassion to be values that are more important than clobbering someone over the head with a passage that has been multiply interpreted and is contradictory with other passages.
Not demanding or pushing a single absolute correct answer to big questions is a powerful thing.
My love, she speaks like silence, without ideals or violence. She doesn't have to say she's faithful, yet she's true like ice, like fire.
For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that fascinating report, Holly. I'm Ray Briggs. With me is my Stanford colleague, Josh Landy. And today, we're thinking about true contradictions.
We're joined now by Graham Priest. He's professor of philosophy at the City University of New York, an author of many excellent things, including Doubt Truth to Be a Liar. Graham, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, guys. Pleased to be with you from New York.
So, Graham, you're a philosopher, and you've written a lot of philosophy, but you're also interested in martial arts. Have you found connections between those two topics?
Sure. I wasn't interested in the martial arts because of philosophy, but there's an historical connection between Buddhism and the martial arts. So practicing the martial arts got me thinking about some issues in Buddhist philosophy, both the ethics and the metaphysics, and I've thought about those quite a bit over the years now.
That's fantastic. Let's get back to true contradictions. They are a lot of fun, at least in my opinion. So what do people have against them?
Well, in Western philosophy, it goes back to Aristotle, who enunciated this thing called the principle of non-contradiction, which is essentially that you can't have a true contradiction. And he gave a bunch of arguments for this, which were frankly terrible, as most modern commentators will agree. But notwithstanding, it sort of entrenched the principle of non-contradiction into the core of Western philosophy, and most Western philosophers since then, with a few notable exceptions, have accepted it without question.
So in your opinion, it's basically dogma.
Yeah.
So what about the argument I was giving with Josh a minute ago, that if you have a true contradiction, you can prove just anything you want?
So the principle that you're referring to is usually called explosion, that from a contradiction, everything follows. And you gave an argument for explosion. We can come back to that in a second. But this principle of explosion is a part of orthodox contemporary logic. That is logic that was formulated towards the end of the 19th century, but it's not orthodox in the history of logic. If you teach Logic 100, then before you've taught any, if you ask students whether, the moon is round and the moon is not round, so Donald Trump is a crook, that's a valid inference, they'll say, no, that's crazy. There's no connection between premises and conclusions. And that seems about right.
So I guess one thing you could think is that contemporary logic has kind of got things wrong and it's overshot. And another opinion you could have is like, well, these logical principles, they were actually true all along and people just didn't know about them. And contemporary logic is an advance. How do I make that judgment?
Well, views on what correct logic is, the correct logic is, if there is one, have been changing now for 2,500 years. And so-called classical logic, that's the logic that was developed by Frege and Russell at the turn of the 20th century, is certainly an advance on what's gone before. But have we got it completely right yet? Probably not, probably never will. Some of the principles that are built into classical logic are highly contentious, as most logicians know. So there's lots of things to think about here, and you can question most things, as you like to say in about your program.
Everything except your intelligence. What about more, I don't know, less sort of logic-based objections and more kind of almost existential objections? So, Nietzsche has this lovely line. He says, my formula for happiness is a yes, a no, a straight line, a goal. So what about just wanting to believe that the world kind of makes sense and hangs together and isn't full of contradictions?
Are you identifying hanging together with not being contradictory?
Yeah, in a very informal way. Yeah, right. So, I want it not just to hang together in a general way, but I want it kind of to make sense and be relatively predictable and consistent. And I want to be able to make claims about things that I don't have to then just sort of retract a minute later.
Well, there's a lot of things going on here, but we'd like to tell a coherent story about the world. It may well be that the best story, the most coherent story we can tell is or has some inconsistent features. You know, we look to science and mathematics and philosophy to tell us what the world is like, and maybe in the end the best story we've got will be an inconsistent one. But as for taking things back, well, you know, any belief we come up with about the world at any time, probably in the future, is going to be a fallible one. And as the evidence evolves and new theories emerge and we discover new things, you might have to take back things you believed. That's just a feature of being an adult, being a rational person. And that's got nothing in particular to do with contradiction.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about true contradictions with Graham Priest from the City University of New York.
Do you have a love-hate relationship with something? Could a judge legislate a contradiction into existence? Could God make a rock so big he couldn't move it?
True, false, both, and neither. Along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. If something ain't so, could it also be so? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about true contradictions with Graham Priest from the City University of New York.
Got a consistent question or a contradictory comment? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and listen to our whole library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Graham, earlier we were considering arguments that there can't be true contradictions. What's the case in favor of true contradictions?
Well, what's the case in favor of the truth of anything? You've got to look at reasons and give reasons. So your question amounts to this. Are there good reasons for supposing that certain contradictions are true? And there's a bunch of these, and probably the one that's got the most airtime in the last 40 or 50 years has been the liar paradox, which you talked about before. But logicians have been struggling with this since it was put on the table by Eubulides 2,500 years ago. And no one has succeeded yet in explaining what's wrong with it, at least if consensus is a mark of success, because there's still no consensus on the matter after 2,500 years. So the thought is, wait, maybe there's nothing wrong with the argument. It's a veridical argument. It establishes a contradiction, and the argument is what it seems, and it's something that establishes its truth.
So that is one possible response, but if I'm kind of an opponent of this view, I might have others. So one thing I might think is, like, there are lots of sentences that aren't true and aren't false. First of all, there are sentences that aren't assertions, like questions, like, is the liar sentence true? Like, that's not a true sentence or a false sentence. But even an assertion, like if it's kind of ill-formed in some way. So if I say that colorless green ideas sleep furiously, I'm not sure that that's true or false. Why couldn't I sort of dismiss the liar sentence and say it's just kind of ill-formed?
Well, there are many views of how you solve the liar paradox. And a very common one is to give it some kind of intermediate or some third status, not true, not false, but non-well-formed, meaningless, not making a proposition, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the problem with all these solutions is that they're subject to something that's usually called revenge paradoxes. So just consider the following statement, and we'll take this carefully for your listeners. This sentence is either false or the third status.
So this sentence is either false or the third status. And then I'm like,
yeah.
What is the status of that?
Well, look, if it's true, it's either false or the third status, and that's a contradiction. If it's false, well, then it's either the false or the third status. So it's true. And now there's the other possibility. It has the third status. But if it has a third status, it's either false or has a third status, so it's true again. So you seem to be back in the problem.
So the idea is, like, once I name what I think the problem with the liar sentence is, I can just say, I'm like, here's the property that makes the liar sentence bad. I can make a new liar sentence that basically says, this sentence is either false or has the bad property, and then I'm just back in the whole mess again.
Correct.
Yeah, and you know, there are so many other lovely paradoxes that I, for one, at least, think are genuine, right? Genuine contradictions in the nature of reality, like Zeno's paradoxes, I find pretty persuasive, and all the stuff about infinity, right? That somehow the set of even numbers is the same size as the set of whole numbers, even though you'd think that the set of whole numbers is larger than the set of even numbers, and Schrodinger's cat that's both dead and not dead. Do you have some other favorites, Graham, other sort of features of the world that you take to be real but also genuinely contradictory?
Well, lots of suggestions have been made in the last 40 or 50 years. They're contentious, but then this is philosophy, so that's okay. But some people, and I find this very plausible, have argued that art has the ability to produce these kinds of things. So there's a famous work of art in the 1920s by Marcel Duchamp called Fountain. And what he did was get a urinal he bought out the hardware store and exhibit it in an art gallery. And there was contention about whether or not this was art. Eventually, the consensus was that it was art, but it was art precisely because it wasn't art.
So I don't know. I have to express a little bit of skepticism about all of these kinds of examples. So sure, Fountain wasn't art by the standards that Duchamp was responding to, and by a more capacious set of standards, it was art. But like, it was art in one sense, and it wasn't art in a different sense. There's no sense in which it both was and wasn't art. Like, why shouldn't I re-describe it in this consistent way?
Yeah, this raises another problem. The notion of art doesn't fall apart like a well-cooked chicken, as you suggest. It's a somewhat vague notion, and it doesn't quite work to cut it up in the way you suggest, which brings us to other paradoxes of vagueness.
So we have a question from Joe in Tel Aviv, who writes, to what extent is the principle of non-contradiction an artifact of a logic that doesn't necessarily inhere in nature? What do you think of that, Graham?
I would like to ask more questions about what the question means. Contradictions are to do with statements or propositions or something that is the case. Now, nature does not obviously comprise such things. It comprises chairs and tables. These aren't the kinds of things that can be consistent or inconsistent. They're just the wrong kind of thing. Now, it may be the case that you can make sense of the thought that nature is consistent or inconsistent, but at that point, I'd like to know more about what this thought means, what the question means by this.
Yeah, so I guess this raises a kind of big bunch of questions for me. So one way you could think about true contradictions is like, oh, we could choose to talk so that we sometimes say, oh, yes, this is true and it's false. And that's just about the way that we talk. And another way of seeing it is that, like, no, there are ways that the world cannot be, that you cannot describe the world to be. And like, it just, you can't have a table that's both in the room and not in the room because of how the table is. So it sounds like you're more on the first side where no true contradictions is a principle about how we talk.
I'm not sure that I accept your distinction. truth is expressed in language. Language is about how we talk. So, of course, if some contradictions are true, then we use language to express that. But that's not a feature of contradictions. That's a feature of truth. Now, we naturally think, probably correctly, that the way we talk describes reality. And when what we say is true, the description is correct. And if certain things we say about reality are true and contradictory, well, in that sense, reality is true and contradictory. That's fine. But that's just, I don't think that's a very surprising view.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about true contradictions with Graham Priest from the City University of New York. And Graham, there's an email from Kevin in San Francisco that kind of goes along the lines of the conversation we were just having about different examples. Kevin says, to say Jesus is both divine and not divine, could this be viewed as a kind of true contradiction? What might be some other examples from Christianity or other religions?
Okay, yeah, well, this was not Orthodox Christianity. This sort of thing could have got you burnt at the stake in the 13th century because of the Aristotelianism of the dominant theological views. But as a matter of fact, there is one well-known contemporary dialethist, J.C. Beale, not today now, who has just published a book arguing that Christ was exactly contradictory in that way.
I want to know what it is about, like, art and religion that make them not susceptible to my consistency technique. Like, you said they were vague, and I want to hear more.
Well, that's such a general question. It's hard to say anything general in reply. But when you meet an apparent contradiction, there's always a move you can make. I've called it parameterization. So you draw a distinction and you say that the one contradictory is true in one sense, another is true in a different sense. But then the challenge is to specify exactly those true senses to justify the thought that indeed one contradictory is true in one sense and the other contradictory is true in another sense, but then to establish that for each of those senses, the chosen limb of the contradiction is consistent in that sense. And that's where the generality gets hard to handle because you have to consider each case on its merits.
I mean, that seems like a pretty good rule for telling the difference between actual contradictions and spurious contradictions that are just sort of artifacts of language. Yeah. I mean, I think of the sophists as depicted in Plato's Dialogues, where they're constantly saying things like, so you're saying your father is both a father and not a father because he's your father, but not my father. And, you know, obviously, well, a father in one sense, and I don't, you know, that's just a kind of trick. Or Renderita says speech is a special kind of writing. He clearly means writing in a special sense. So is that, what do you think, Graham? Is that a good sort of principle for warding off these kind of spurious contradictions that just really just artifacts of language, and that, you know, if you could put quotation marks around one of the terms and show that it's being used in a special sense, that's going to rule it out. Whereas on your side of the line are things like the liar paradox, where you can't make that move.
Sure. That I mean, getting rid of an apparent contradiction like this in that way, in the way you describe, is obviously the right thing to do sometimes. Let's say it's 1:30 and 10:30. That sounds like a contradiction, but it's not because we draw a distinction. It's 1:30 in New York and 10:30 in San Francisco. So that's the right thing to do with some apparent contradictions. Now, is it the right thing to do with every contradiction? Well, if you think it is, then the onus is on you to spell out the disambiguation, the parameterization, the two different respects, and establish that once you have drawn a distinction, then you've got rid of the problem. But this move does not come for free, because once you've drawn the distinction, you've got two apparent contradictions, one in each of the two senses, and then the onus is on you to show that those two contradictions or those two different senses are both consistent. And as we've seen with the case of the liar paradox, it's not at all obvious you can always do that. In the end, you have to consider each one on a case-by-case basis.
So right now people use a logic that does not allow true contradictions, or at least most people use a logic that doesn't allow for true contradictions and that has this explosion problem.
You mean people or philosophers?
I mean philosophers. That's fair. Most philosophers like explosion. People probably don't. But, like, are philosophers inventing logic, or are they discovering logic? Like, are there truths about logic that you can discover, or can you just be like, I'm going to select whichever logical language is convenient for me?
That's a good question. That's an interesting question. Look, logic is about what follows from what, crudely, and what follows from what is not at all obvious, and it's a question we theorize about. And we theorize about nearly everything that has any profound significance in life. We theorize in physics, in metaphysics, in ethics, in mathematics, in law, in philosophy, and in logic. And people have been theorizing about what follows from what, as I say, for 2,500 years, and we're coming up with new and better theories all the time. So in that sense, we are creating new logics. They're a human creation, like any theory. But the thing we're theorizing about is presumably not a human creation. We're trying to get the facts right.
Yeah, and, you know, if we're trying to get the facts right about the world, it seems to me you're really onto something in saying the world kind of is a little bit more weird than people might think, right? And, yeah, we've talked about some examples in the realm, for example, of physics and you know, infinity and things like that. What about examples that come from the human heart, right? So, you know, I'm a big fan of La Rochefoucauld, who is a 17th century French thinker, and he has all these paradoxes. For example, when you're in love, you doubt what you most believe. Do you think there are true contradictions when it comes to the inner world, the world of our beliefs, emotions, our mental life?
Well, maybe. I mean, any examples are going to be contentious, right? Because there's always the parameterizing move which can be made, and you've got to consider each case on its merits. But certainly you might put up cases of this kind. Here's another one. You've maybe had the experience where you drive past this really gruesome traffic accident, and there's blood and there are body parts all over the road. And it's so horrific that you cannot but look. So you're attracted and you're repelled by it at the same kind. Your cognitive state is drawn in this way. So it's both attractive and repulsive. Now, you might want to say that those are not really contradictory, and we then have to argue about whether or not they are. But a case can be made that they are. And if they are contradictory, this is a contradictory affair of the heart, to use your language.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today, we're talking about true contradictions with Graham Priest, author of Doubt Truth to Be a Liar.
Could embracing contradictions make us more open-minded? Or is it a recipe for disaster? What are the consequences for science?
Embracing the impossible, plus commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. What did you expect to find in the land of be and not be? You could be and not be right. If you're both mine and not mine, is that a healthy relationship? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Graham Priest from the City University of New York, and we're thinking about true contradictions.
So, Graham, we've got a comment from Raphael in Berkeley. Raphael says, I always thought that being comfortable with contradiction is the answer to some of the hard problems in ethics, like the trolley problem. There are some situations in which the best thing to do is really only the least bad thing to do, and it might result in someone's death or suffering. And the actor should still feel culpable, even though there was no better choice. That's part of the tragedy of the situation. Maybe this isn't exactly a contradiction, but the right thing to do is still wrong, I guess, would be the formulation that makes it into a contradiction. So what do you think, Graham? Is that, are those kinds of thing a contradiction, a true contradiction?
Yeah, that's interesting. The sort of situation that the listener is gesturing at are sometimes called dilemmas. So a dilemma is a situation where you ought to do something and you ought to do something else, and those two things are compatible. So if you like, you ought to bring it about that A, you ought to bring it about that not A. And I really think that there are certainly such things in ethics. Our values often conflict, and that's just a factor of life. But that's not a contradiction. Let me say it again. A dilemma, the sort of thing I've been describing, is where you ought to bring it about that A and you ought to bring it about that not A. Okay? A contradiction would be you ought to bring it about that A and it's not the case that you ought to bring it about that A. Now, it's not so obvious that there are such things. I actually kind of think there are. I think that norms themselves are generally subject to dilithes, but you need a lot more work to get to normative dilithes than you do to get to normative dilemmas.
So, okay, yeah. So we can have normative dilemmas where there's something you ought to do and also that you ought to do another incompatible thing, but not normative dilithes where it's true and false that you ought to do a thing.
Well, I didn't say you couldn't have them. I actually think there are. But I think the case for normative dilemmas is pretty straightforward. The case for dilithias is much more complicated and much more contentious.
Got it. So what would be an example of a normative dilithia, if there is one?
Well, let me give you a hypothetical example, because it strips off some irrelevant features. But consider law. Okay. Laws are systems of norms, of course. And you can imagine that a duly constituted legislature passes a law to the effect that it's concerned with granting and taking away rights. And one clause of the law might say, people in category X have the right to vote. People in category Y don't have the right to vote. And X might be property holders, rich men, people who vote for a certain party, okay? People in the case of Y might be, you know, women or people of color or, you know, choose your categories. And as long as no one is actually in categories X and Y, then things are perfectly consistent. But you can imagine that as society evolves, someone in category X and Y turns up. So maybe one law said property owners have the right to vote, but women don't have the right to vote. And then as the law, as society changes, some women hold property. Then in that case, this person who is in category X and Y both does and doesn't have the right to vote. And that is a normative dilithia.
We've got a question from Joshua in Portland, who asks, isn't the exploding of these contradictions the basis of dialectics? Like a hinge separates a door from the wall, but also connects it. Is that a true contradiction?
I'd want to know more about what dialectics is doing here. The word dialectics gets thrown around in many different ways. But certainly in the history of philosophy, one of the philosophers who's most closely connected with the notion of dialectic is Hegel. And Hegel is, in my books, one of the few philosophers in the history of Western philosophy who was prepared to go against Aristotle and the law of non-contradiction. Because in the dialectical process, in the way that concepts evolve for Hegel, contradictions do arise and they're transcended, but that does not mean that you get rid of them. They're preserved in a certain sense. So for that notion of dialectics, at least, I think there's a good case to be made that dialectics is committed to dialethism.
So Graham, what do you think? I mean, I love true contradictions. They make me very happy. But are there any practical consequences? Are there any consequences, for example, for science from thinking about the world this way?
That's a good question. I think perhaps the most interesting possible practical contradiction is this. Science uses mathematics, okay? That's not news. And at various times in the past, science has used inconsistent mathematics. That might be a surprise to some listeners, but the case is pretty obvious. In the 17th century, when Newton produced his theory of gravitation, he had to invent a whole new branch of mathematics to do the mathematics, and it was called the infinitesimal calculus. And infinitesimals had inconsistent properties. They were both zero and non-zero at different points in the mathematical calculations. And this was well known. It was pointed out by Berkeley. So physicists are prepared to use inconsistent mathematics. Now, I'm not sure there are any good cases at the moment where this is in fact the case. But because of the developments in paraconsistent mathematics, that is mathematics which based on logics which accept contradictions, we are now developing inconsistent mathematics in the full knowledge that it's inconsistent, and we know what we're doing for the first time. Now, who knows what applications this mathematics will bear in the future? Often mathematics is developed without a particular application, and then physicists find applications for it later. Could this happen in the future of physics? Well, maybe.
So I know how the story about infinitesimals ends, which is actually with the thing you called reparametrization. Like, eventually mathematicians came up with a consistent description. So one way of thinking about what was happening in the meantime is that physicists had a theory that wasn't true. It was contradictory. But that's a case where, like, reparametrization was the right answer. So it's maybe weak evidence that, like, science, like, fully developed science shouldn't use contradictions.
A small point. It wasn't resolved because of parameterization. It was resolved because infinitesimals were gotten rid of from the menagerie of mathematical objects.
So, right. So we replaced them with a different definition of what a limit was, and we did all of our calculus in terms of limits, and that was consistent.
Well, yeah, so the notion of a limit was invented, and it got rid of infinitesimals. But I gave that example merely to show that physicists are prepared to work with inconsistent mathematics, and they will use whatever mathematics makes the right predictions. And if it turns out that inconsistent mathematics makes the right predictions, then they'll use it. And at least while there's no better theory, they'll take that to be a correct description of reality. Will better theories turn up in due course? Who knows? Maybe they will, maybe they won't. Maybe they'll be inconsistent, maybe they won't. When it comes to predicting the future of science, most bets are off.
That makes sense. And, you know, my bet would be that Zeno's paradoxes are going to stay with us because, you know, he makes some pretty good arguments for thinking there is a smallest unit of space or time, and good arguments for thinking there isn't a smallest unit of space or time. And, wow, that's a real fracture in the world, which brings me to a different kind of consequence for embracing true contradictions, which is one of my favorite quotes from Jorge Luis Borges, who in one of his essays says, "We have dreamt the world." It's a very Buddhist line, getting back to Buddhism, right? We've dreamt the world. We've dreamt it as firm and durable. But in its architecture, we've allowed crevices of unreason which tell us it is false. It's such a beautiful cosmological hypothesis that, you know, that being able to detect these true contradictions in the fabric of the world opens our minds, or could open our minds, to the possibility that something very interesting is going on. Maybe humanity somehow collectively dreamt the experience that we're having. What do you think about that kind of, it's very, obviously very lyrical, but do you think there could be something to it?
Well, I like Borges too. He's one of my favorite writers. The view that he describes in this short story is a version of idealism, to the effect that essentially reality is some kind of mental fabrication. I guess I've always been a kind of knee-jerk reaction realist. But one of the features of realism is that the world is bloody complicated and probably much more complicated than we will ever understand. And one lesson you should draw from that, if it's right, is a certain humility. If reality is much more complicated than we can ever hope to get our head around completely, then you must be prepared to realize that the things you thought about it are indeed wrong, and not because it's our dream, but because reality is like that. And so you shouldn't necessarily believe what you've been taught in Philosophy 100 or Physics 100 or Logic 100, because these views are going to be revised probably indefinitely as we try to get our heads around the nature of this complex reality. So there's a lesson about humility here, about our grasp of the world.
So, Graham, if you wanted to give our listeners one thing that they could take away to remind them to challenge sort of what they'd been dogmatically told and get different perspectives on logic, what would you tell them?
Well, the bottom line advice is think for yourself. We all believe things because we're told. I mean, if you think about it, most of the things we believe them because we're told. Facts about geography, facts about science, facts about religion, facts about ethics. And we often don't question these. I mean, you can't question them, but you need to take some things for granted to act on. But one thing you should do is, when the appropriate occasion arises, question these things. And that's exactly one of the things that is great about philosophy. You have the liberty, and in fact, the imperative, to step back and think about and question these things. So, you know, when options, new options arise, don't just write them off because you say, well, you know, I was taught it doesn't work like that in Philosophy 100 or Logic 100. Think about the reasons that are involved. Think about the pros and cons and examine these things that you've taken for granted.
Graham, unfortunately, we're out of time, and I wish that meant we were also not out of time. But alas, it just means we're out of time. Thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
Our guest has been Graham Priest, professor of philosophy at the City University of New York, and author of Doubt Truth to Be a Liar. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, I'm thinking that while we've seen that, like, a lot of Western philosophy doesn't like true contradictions because of Aristotle, there's this whole other Buddhist tradition which didn't have this one guy hating on true contradictions, and so which develops this really sophisticated way of treating them.
Yeah, they were blessedly spared Aristotle. And, you know, Borges has it more right than this long history of Western thinking. We're going to put links to Borges and Aristotle and everything else we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog.
Now, a man so fast he outruns even himself, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, America loves a story about George Washington chopping down the cherry tree and confessing to Papa. The story is not true, but the lie reveals the truth about Washington, allegedly. Recently, another president got us in a tizzy, griping about fake news and rigged elections, but he's kind of a liar himself, which is maybe why truth seems so false these days, more like a cultural fad led by conservatives. Take this from Ben Shapiro, quote, "Our legacy media do not tell you the whole truth. They generally pick and choose the narratives they think you are allowed to be told," unquote. Tucker Carlson also said this after losing his gig at Fox. Editors edit the news. That's why Glenn Greenwald is on Substack. And now, as of this writing, Tucker is migrating his show to Twitter, where Elon Musk has made a home for free speech. That's the narrative. Tucker also claimed that we will all be replaced by immigrants. This is actually called the replacement theory. So, okay, Mexican guy crosses the border, gets busted in New York to take a copywriting job away from a man of German Lutheran ancestry. How does that work? Is it just, get out of here, Bob. Jose's got the account now. Who gives the ugly truth to Bob? Some woke guy from Disney, I'll bet. Up from Florida after DeSantis kicked them all out. Some Imagineer bureaucrat. A consultant. I thought it was all influencers now anyway. Didn't artificial intelligence take over replacing truth and advertising with a database of lies as beautiful as a phone call? Half the country still thinks Trump is president. Who's to say it's not true? Just the other week, Senator Grassley and Representative Comer drafted a letter posted on Twitter to Attorney General Garland and FBI Director Wray. They said an alleged whistleblower, allegedly, has filed a form with the DOJ and FBI containing a precise description of the employment and purpose of an alleged criminal scheme between then-Vice President Biden and a foreign national. Though Grassley and Comer have a, quote, growing concern about the DOJ and FBI's track record of allowing political bias to infect their decision-making process, unquote, they are requesting to see this form. Quote, based on the alleged specificity within the document, it would appear that the DOJ and FBI have enough information to determine its truth and accuracy, unquote. In other words, DOJ and FBI, this evidence, which may or may not exist, of a scheme which may or not be real, and which you may or may not possess, leads us to ask you to give it to us. Otherwise, we may have to investigate why we don't have it. Who's going to fact check that? What facts are there to check? A blue check mark used to mark you on Twitter as somebody who might know something. No, it's a participation trophy you pay for. Thanks, Elon. I just read a tweet by some conservative activists calling for observers for every election day from now on. Post yourself around polling places. Look out for fake ballots, for people trying to sneak ballots in. The poster called them scrutineers. Maybe DeSantis could post scrutineers around Disney World to keep the Imagineers in line. Truth is fungible, in other words, with your good credit. I'd like to blame Trump for this, but we can also blame the legal system and the media. Right now, there are non-zero men on death row who have been exonerated, theoretically, because DNA matched the real killer. And the guy is still in prison. New trials cost money. We're tired of science proving everything. Whatever happened to legwork and planting evidence? Once the verdict is in, it should be true. When the condemned are innocent, it just throws justice into a cocked hat. That's why Trump likes being president. He can do anything he wants to. Presidents are innocent beings like angels. Remember, he's prepared to alter reality using his own electors? And before you know it, he'd have been president again, yammering to us 24-7 about whatever grievance he can scrape up. No, wait, he is doing that. I think it'd be hard to maintain the victim pose when you're running to be the leader of the free world, or as some claim, still are the leader of the free world, but here we are. I cannot tell a lie, he lied. Is this the way? This way is not the way. Or is it? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
I cannot tell a lie.
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 I cannot tell a lie. I'm sorry, buddy.